Heidi, you there? Are you not unmuted?
Sorry, it just cut me off for a second. I didn't hear you introduce me. I'm Heidi. I'm Crow Kennett. I'm here. Okay, I was like, where did everybody go? I just got to keep plugged in here. Hi, everybody. I'm happy to be here. I'm going to jump right into the work. Just really quickly introduce myself. I've been in CODA for 14 years on the 4th of July. And my birthday is just coming right up. So that's exciting. That's also my belly button birthday. The topic of arresting obsession is not my favorite thing to speak on. You know, there's other funner things to me, but I will say that it was one of the most significant leveling up of my recovery when I finally could stop overthinking things and have boundaries with my thinking and obsession. One of the most important parts of being able to be available for my relationship with God, you know, for my relationship with my inner children, to be present for my day, to be available for, you know, happiness and joy and all those things. And, obsession was definitely costing me.
Heidi, can you hear me? You froze up.
Yeah, we lost audio. Heidi?
And video. I can try texting her as well.
Heidi, are you there? You're on mute if you are.
Okay. I just unhooked again. Like my cord isn't working right. So I'll keep trying to get that to work. Sorry. So that was my, you know, my default. And so here I am doing steps and I'm trying to understand and I'm trying to be in my feelings. And I've got this continuous cycle that I just keep getting stuck in. And, you know, and I finally put my attention on it as opposed to using it to put my attention on everything else, you know? And I started, you know, because the things that I was obsessing about were the things that felt like the problem. And what I didn't realize is the obsession itself was the problem. And, that anything that I put that kind of, fear-based, attention to is going to look like a problem, be a problem. I'll turn it into a problem, you know? And some of those things that I would put my obsession on did require my time and attention. They did need to be processed or thought about or decisions made or whatever. But the method that I was using to go about it was, you know, a hammer and a chisel, not a softer, gentler, caring method, you know? And so, when I came to realize like how harsh my thinking was, and, then it helped me to direct it and it was a hard reality that I was addicted. And, you know, you don't know you're addicted until you try to stop, right? And then it became really obvious that like, I can't stop, you know, and probably most of you have that experience with obsession that like you tell yourself, I'm going to stop thinking about this, whatever it is. If it's someone at work that pissed you off, or if it's, you know, your ex, or if it's, you know, some nagging thing that you didn't get done, that's waiting for you to still finish, you know, whatever it is, like, I'm going to stop thinking about that. That's bothering me. It's taking me away from my life right now, or my serenity, or it's, you know, robbing me of my peace of mind, or I can't be present, or whatever, you know, the story is. And then next thing you know, you've been thinking about it for 20 minutes and you never even knew that you all of a sudden were thinking about it again. Like it's just running in your head, you know? So, you know, I spent years trying to stop thinking about my ex-husband, you know, and went over and over and over in my head, all of the harm that he did. And, you know, he harmed me for whatever amount of time he harmed me for. I took that harm and re-harmed me over and over every day. And when I finally came to hit that bottom and say, I'm doing harm to me now because I can't stop thinking about it, because I can't stop replaying my victimization, the pain involved. And then, of course, all of the domino effect of that, you know, now I have to be enraged. Now I have to play the victim. Now I have to take his inventory. Now I have to create a fantasy story about how the next man is going to be perfect. You know, all of the patterns and characteristics that come about, you know, not so much because of what he did, more about because I refuse to feel the feelings and I'm so busy in my obsession addiction up in my head, thinking that's the answer, thinking that I'm somehow going to find some miracle solution up here, you know. But really, I'm just avoiding taking care of me. I'm avoiding being in my feelings. And so I'm going to go ahead and start. If can I do this screen share thing, Lydia?
I think you should be able to as a co-host. I think
Let me see if I can grab this. Is that the PowerPoint? Yes. So I have a PowerPoint. Yay me. okay. Can you guys see it? Okay. Some nodding.
Arresting obsession looks
okay.
Good.
Okay. Great. All right. So, I also want to say before I get started that, I put my email and phone number in the chat. So if you find at any point that you want to reach out to me, the information is there in the chat. I tried to drag and drop the PowerPoint in a PDF form into the chat, but it wouldn't go. So I don't know if there's some setting where people can't do it, because when we were practicing, I was able to do it. So I'll let my team sort of look at that and maybe give me some direction or change some settings or something. But in the meantime, I'll get started. So we get a lot of material to go through here. So, anyway, okay, how do I do that? All right, what is obsession? It's ugly. It's compulsive addictive thinking patterns and a form of fantasy addiction that's triggered to medicate the buried toxic shame that drives codependence. And that is my definition, you know, from some reliable sources, but, you know, kind of translated into CODA language. The dictionary says that obsession is a preoccupation, an idea or feeling that completely occupies the mind, uncontrollable persistence of an idea, sometimes associated with psychiatric disorder. That would be in my case, for sure. What does obsession look like? Digging in your head, desperately trying to figure it out. There's some big secret in there that if I can just get to it, it will rescue everything, save everything, solve all my problems. There will be some miracle cure there, you know, and I just got that hammer and chisel out, you know, or the jackhammer, you know, and I'm just up in there, just working it hard, going it over the data over and over and over. Analyzing, dissecting, you know, and that's my flavor. You know, other people have a different flavor of obsession. So let's go through these a little bit. Worrying about something that might happen in the future and all the possible scenarios. Let me just go at it from this angle. Oh, now I'll go at it from this angle. Oh, now I'll try it from this angle. What could go wrong? Oh my gosh, there's a million possibilities. Let me just explore every single one of those. Somehow that little girl inside feels like if she could just figure out what's going to happen next or figure out what is going to go wrong, then somehow she can avoid it. She can control it. She can bypass it. She can solve it. You know, all this is, it comes from the dysfunctional family and the toxic you know, the toxic family and abuse and neglect and all those things that create our codependent stories. And so of course obsession was, you know, one of those things that, I learned very, very young, you know, and got better and better at. So it also looks like idealizing or romanticizing about something or someone that you want. So I can have negative fantasy and obsession, or I can have positive fantasy and obsession, you know, building up something into some kind of amazing, experience that's coming, or some for sure thing, and create some big world of, you know, relief for myself, or something to look forward to, or something to lean into to avoid feelings, you know, usually. And I can just stay stuck in that and miss out on the real world, you know, trying to find the perfect thought that will make sense of everything or fix everything or figure it all out. Obsession for me also sometimes looks like flip-flopping with a choice or a judgment and causing more confusion. I'll play the devil's advocate over here, and then I'll, as soon as I, you know, run that out to the nth degree, then I'll flip sides and I'll be like, oh, but, and then I'll start on the but, you know, and then make the whole but list, you know, making stories up about what someone will think, say, do, or feel, you know, and that kind of obsession I feel like is one of the ones that I've used that does the most harm, because when I put my mind in the framework of inserting myself into someone else's head or into their life or into their values or into their wants and desires, you know, I'm offending, essentially. I'm crossing boundaries. And I'm characterizing them with all the, you know, with all the insanity that's going on in my head. I'm characterizing them with that. And I haven't, you know, I no longer am, you know, in touch with the reality of that relationship with that person. Now I'm caught up in the fantasy stories I'm telling myself about that person. And those could be vast and have no grounding in reality at all about that person, or be very exaggerated, you know, especially like if I'm obsessing about somebody and something they did wrong, then all of a sudden they never did anything right. They only did everything wrong. They've only done things to hurt me. They've only, you know, they've only hid out from me. They've only betrayed me. They've only lied to me. They've always pushed me away. They've always this, they've always that. And there's no balance in that. And obsession will do that to me. Replaying over and over what someone did to you and building up resentment or victimization. I kind of just went over that. Ignoring something important and daydreaming about unimportant or mundane things in our life, you know, using obsession as a way to avoid my responsibilities, my obligations, uncomfortable things that I don't want to look at. Overanalyzing your choices when trying to make a decision until you're beating a dead horse, you know, like I'm just exhausted. And I've thought about it. I have nothing new, you know, there's like no new material and I still keep doing it. Intensely questioning and doubting a decision that you already made. Just because you can't stop, you know, criticizing yourself with stories of what you should have done, you know, going back over the past and obsessing about it. I should have said this. I should have said that. Oh, I forgot to mention this. Or when that person said that, this would have been the perfect answer. And then they would have done this. And then I would have done that. And it would have changed everything, you know, and obsession, you know, is just make-believe. Let's see, fixating on a person to figure them out, you know, and again, truly from where I stand now, it's not only offensive to somebody, you know, to take their inventory in that way, but also I'm self-abandoning, you know? So let's go look at, obsession in a nutshell. So it starts out like ordinary thinking. I think I'm just thinking about life, right? But it intensifies the deeper I get into the fear. It's like it grabs you like quicksand and sucks you down and builds into a mental self-assault, creating anxiety or panic, sometimes fear, like getting little, you know, rage, desperation, and usually shame is involved. for me. So why do we obsess? You know, like the obvious answer, why do we use all of our patterns and characteristics? You know, it manages and controls feelings. You know, so intense, focused, detailed, obsessive thinking drives out, you know, feelings like I'm, you know, cut off from here, up in here, just working it. And so those feelings just don't have any room to be acknowledged or to come, you know, to come into view, or so I'm just driving them out. So like, for instance, if I focus on fearful thoughts, then it can drive out loneliness. You know, I hate being lonely, and I didn't even know I was lonely for years. I didn't know. And it was part of, you know, when I started to arrest the fearful thoughts, this loneliness came up, and I'm like, what the hell is this? Well, it was what the fear was saw. It was the, what was the fear was fixing. The fear was fixing that loneliness, the feeling of being alone or being abandoned. And so I, as a child, I learned these chronic, or I learned a chronic worry, you know, and if I can chronic worry, then there's all this activity in my head, and I'm up in my head, and I'm not in that space of nothingness, you know, that space of abandonment, that space of no one is here, no one loves me, I'm not important, I don't matter, I'm lost, you know. And so getting in that worry of, oh, I got to do this, oh, I forgot to do that, oh, I have to get an A on my report, or I need to go, I can't forget about this person, and oh, they need me to call them, you know. And and so of course that earlier stages, and then it develops and develops and develops, you know, all addiction is progressive. So that's one example. Another one is angry thoughts can drive out powerlessness, again, being one of like those feelings that I don't want to do, you know? So if I get angry and I'm enraged and I'm in judgment, you know, like anger usually comes out as judgment towards somebody, I've got a one up going on. You know, I think I know better than them. I'm kind of dissecting their life, or I'm, you know, placing all these judgment values on them. They should have done this. Why didn't they do that? They never do this. Then I don't have to feel that powerlessness. But truly what I'm doing is I'm obsessing. I'm just obsessing in a very negative way. So what is really the problem? Is it my anger or is it my obsession? And anger just happens to be the mechanism that my obsession is using in order to fix the feeling. You know, it's, again, it's being up in my head, you know? So I'm going to skip down a little bit and go to the next part. Provides us with temporary relief, a distraction or hope. And, you know, again, addiction that was built from a very young child that was really just looking for relief right here in the moment. But then once it takes hold and becomes just a chronic part of your, how you deal with life, you know, then of course it's no longer an innocent child's coping mechanism. It becomes very destructive and self-destructive. It offers connection with others when we obsess together. So, you know, looking back over my obsession history and that addiction, I knew, you know, through the years who I could call and obsess with, and they would obsess with me. Just like I knew who to call that would do drugs with me or go drink with me or talk shit with me, you know, about people or men or bitch about my job or whatever it was, you know. And so, you know, I didn't even realize until I got into recovery that like all my relationships are based on this. You know, I don't have relationships where I sit with people and talk about my future and my dreams and the things I love about my life, you know, that all of my relationships were really focused on bitching about stuff, obsessing about stuff with somebody else, finding a using buddy, and then amplifying all that energy around, you know, my victimization or my anger or my how something was, you know, unfair and they're so wrong or whatever, you know. And all that is just a huge fix for the vulnerability that I didn't want to feel, the powerlessness that I didn't want to feel, the emptiness I didn't want to feel. So creating conversation in your head to avoid feeling alone. Again, it's kind of like this white noise. It's just this default that's always going on. You know, I didn't know how to be quiet. I didn't know how to sit with myself. Take a breath. Be in my body. Just allow things to be okay. You know, those are skills I didn't have for years in CODA. Thank God for that. To avoid fear or commitment. To avoid fear or commitment, fear of commitment. By alternating different choice scenarios. So, you know, if I've got a fear of commitment going on, then, you know, then I can play the pro and con list game, you know, oh, well, here's all the pros or here's all the cons or here's this choice and then here's that choice, and go back and forth and obsess and obsess and obsess. And I don't have to pick something and move forward, you know, seeking the thought, the fantasy, the story, the scenario, the answer to create a good feeling to medicate bad feelings. So I'm just looking for that little magic answer that's somehow going to make it all, like just put this, you know, big rainbow wave of nicety all over something instead of the emotional maturity that it takes to walk through stuff. Family role modeling. Like, it's important to take a look at how your parents handled decisions or disappointment, being hurt or having disagreements. Like, did they have emotional maturity around those things or did they use obsession? And my parents both were obsession addicts and dragged us kids into it. Their obsession was usually out loud. They would talk a lot, you know, I mean, some people grew up in a household where nobody talked, and that was not my household. My parents told us everything, way too much that ever should have been said, and projected all of their obsessive fears all over us kids. Did a lot of harm with that. Thinking is like a place to go away to. It seems safer than being or feeling. Like I said, I just learned how to live from here up. You know, everything down below my neck wasn't safe. I was always just safe in there. As children in dysfunctional homes, our choices were limited and thinking was one thing we could control to get relief. You know, it's like my secret little place I can have, you know, I can fix, but nobody knows that I'm afraid. Nobody knows that I feel guilty. Nobody know, you know, and it wasn't safe to be honest or reach out or ask for help or tell somebody what was going on. I'd been let down too many times. It wasn't safe to be vulnerable. So, you know, there wasn't a whole lot that I could do, and obsession was something that was in my power. The critical, demanding voice of obsession may feel like home and offer comfort, even though it's doing harm. I didn't know for years and years and years that it was a problem, you know, and, you know, especially when I would first start, you know, like, you know, get off work and go sit in the car and start commuting home and then pick something up and start with it. And I just had no idea where that would land, you know, and that by the time I got home, I had gotten myself so worked up and I'd been in so much self-abandonment in my head and I had catastrophized everything that I was gonna, you know, walk in the door and blow up at somebody for leaving their shoes in the living room, you know? Because I had self-abandoned, gotten up here and had all this story going on about all the things I have to do and all the things that I have to get done and how overwhelming my life is and blah, 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 blah. And then all it takes is like the straw that broke the camel's back for me to then just unload and just rage or be really vulnerable and feel totally betrayed by somebody's callous remark or offhand behavior, you know? So another why is to create the illusion of power or choice in a powerless situation. And I found myself obsessing a lot about things that weren't my fault. There wasn't anything I could do about it. I did not like how that felt. So at least I would feel safer if I could analyze it, judge it, beat it up. But I didn't know I was beating me up in the process. Why is my screen not? There we go. So obsession is not actually making our lives better or different. It only makes our feelings better or different for a minute. Just like a beer. I'm an addict. I'm an addict, and I've got 22 years clean now. And an obsession is no different than a beer. You know, that first fantasy thought, you know, was that first beer. And then obsession that takes me to, you know, the gateway drug, let's say, you know, that first beer that takes me to the 12 pack, you know, and that by the time an hour has gone by and I've gotten myself completely worked up or completely freaked out, or I've made up lots of stories, or I have completely villainized somebody, or, you know, totally lost my power to something, or got really big and one up, you know, got a big head about something. And then it's like, oh, if only I could go back and just have a beer or two, right? Mm-hmm. In truth, obsession is a drug. And when we use it, we are avoiding and neglecting our lives, our feelings, and ourselves. When the obsession is past, we are right where we were before, except usually feeling a little more confused and beat up. So what does it cost us? And I've talked about most of this, so I'm going to kind of breeze through it a little bit. Usually ends in a shame spiral for me. Overreacting, frozen, resentful, feeling very alone, beat up, or hopeless. Like all addictions, it's progressive. So we have to use harder just to feel normal. You know, have to work harder at figuring it out, whatever that looks like. The addiction tells us the problem is out there, when the biggest problem is now the addiction itself. It's not necessarily the subject that I'm on. Over time, the addiction becomes normalized and transparent to us, even though we're not getting much relief. Just like the beer, right? You know, or just like any addiction. But I have to use just to feel okay, even though I don't really feel okay. It's definitely not fixing it anymore. But I just can't stop because I don't have another way to cope with my feelings. Over time, the addiction becomes normalized and transparent to us, even though we're not getting much relief. I just read that part. Let's see. We learn to catastrophize things so we have more material for our addiction and to justify why we do it. As the addiction progresses, we often scare ourselves into a state of paralysis and can't do anything. Often we forget how to feel and intellectualize our feelings instead. And then we create toxicity and disease in that, you know, that I'm always thinking about things instead of feel and release, feel and release, feel and care for, feel and respond to the needs that those feelings are telling me about. You know, if I'm in fear, I need to soothe it. You know, if I'm in anger, you know, I need to, you know, breathe, tolerate, slow down, and find my safety. You know, if I'm in sadness, I need to comfort, you know, but if I'm always in obsession instead, I don't build emotional maturity. I don't build emotional care skills. We try alternating multiple obsessions in order to manage the consequences, like switching drugs. So if I get unmanageability about thinking about my ex, now I'm going to obsess about where I'm going to take my vacation, you know? And so, oh my gosh, should I go to, you know, should I go over here and do this with these people, or should I go over here and do this with these people? You know, well, all the pros and cons. Well, if I do this, then this will happen. And if I do this, then this will happen. But this person never gets out and I hardly ever see him, you know, but then this is free and it'll save me money, and, you know, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And sooner or later you wear yourself out on that and you just go back to thinking about the ex-husband. You know, it's just like this chronic busyness. So thinking about things eventually leads to acting on them, and the unmanageability intensifies as we overreact. So again, once I work it all up and then walk in the door, I've got like no tolerance. And then that's when I'm going to start acting on it. I'm going to usually rage, or I'm going to shame spiral. I'm going to send a text when I need to pray instead. I'm going to confront somebody. I'm I'm less of a passive codependent, but a passive codependent is going to be more likely to shut down, get quiet, avoid people, you know, some of those characteristics, you know, because of all the story that they've made up in their head. I'm not safe. They're mad at me. They're not going to listen to me. I'm going to be just, you know, I'm going to be abandoned, or they're going to yell at me, or they're going to tell everybody all my secrets, or, you know, the stories, you know, that we lose our power to. And that all happens through obsession. Eventually we can feel trapped in the cycle of confusion and overwhelm, landing us back in the feelings of shame that we were trying to avoid. So have I convinced you guys yet that obsession is probably not a good idea? So obsession doesn't work. And this was my bottom, you know, like really facing the reality of, when did it ever help me gain clarity or make better decisions? Like, when was it really caring about my life, even though I absolutely thought I had to do it and follow it out to the umpth degree, that I had to just let my head run and just seek and seek and seek and seek and figure it out and figure it out and figure it out. It doesn't work. So let's switch gears and get into the solution here. So working the steps on obsession. So step one, you know, we admitted that we were powerless over others, and that's our coda first step. But in this case, we're talking about our powerlessness over obsession, and that our lives had become unmanageable. And, you know, this was a first step thing for me. Obsession was a first step, you know, thing for me. I didn't get to just put it on my list of character defects. It was straight up an addiction. I really had to take it to the first step in order to get any relief. And take it seriously. And I had to do that over other things too, you know, like love addiction, like raging, like workaholism. I mean, so I've done a lot of first steps, you know, but obsession was a big one for me. And, you know, thank God that I sort of, stepped up my recovery around that. When I finally realized that it's not all the things that I think are going wrong in my life, it's the obsession itself. Not, you know, not that there's not other defects of character and other things that are going on, but the obsession, the addiction to overthinking things, the addiction to trying to figure it out. So here's where you guys get to do a little work. And I want to encourage you all to walk through these questions with me. Like I said, I would really like to give everybody access to this PowerPoint afterwards so that you could maybe do a deeper dive if this work feels like it would be good and you want to do it. I want to make these available to people. If we don't figure out how to get the PowerPoint into the chat for you guys to download, I did put my email address in the chat. You can email me and I'll send you a PDF of it. Okay. So we have that solved. So what obsessions am I ready to give up? Well, none, you know, I mean, you know, here's the thing. As an addict, I wanted to give up, you know, drinking a 12 pack, but I didn't want to give up the first 3 beers, let's say, you know, I didn't want to give up the buzz. I didn't want to give up the shutting the feelings down. I really didn't want to get clean. I just wanted the pain to go away, you know? And so, you know, when it comes to obsession, I had to be willing to give up the first beer, which is that first obsessive thought, that first diving in, that first, whew, I'm going in, and because once I lose my power to that, that thing that happens in my head, that train of thought, that, you know, that repetitive hamster wheel of going over it and going over it and going over it, I can't just have one. I can't just obsess for 5 minutes. I can't just obsess for 15 minutes. I can't stop obsessing until it hurts. You know, I can't stop obsessing until I'm kneeled over the toilet puking my guts out. And I don't know if you guys are those kinds of addicts, right? But by the time I'm done obsessing, and it depends on the intensity, this doesn't happen every time about every subject, but I've certainly experienced this a lot. You know, I have hurt myself, and I've, you know, taken what someone else did to me that hurt, and I've compounded it. You know, I've taken a fear I have, and I've made it real, and I've scared the shit out of myself. You know, I've taken a good friend and made them a villain who's out to get me. You know, that's what obsession does. It ruins relationships. I mean, it destroys them in my thinking, you know, and then if I act on them, it destroys them, you know, for real, or does harm to them at least. So what obsessions am I ready to give up? And, you know, that's going to be between you and your higher power. You know, where is it doing harm? And, you know, part of the obsession for me that I had to definitely work on, that was pretty obvious in my CODA work, was the obsession to finding fault with me. You know, the going in and ridiculing and criticizing and taking my inventory and, you know, like, there's this story my little kid had about if she could figure out everything wrong with herself before everybody else did and change it or fix it or hide it, then she would somehow be okay. And that never worked. All it did was keep my head very focused on all of my mistakes and all of my perceived mistakes and all of my shortcomings and all of my vulnerability and all of my weaknesses and all of my pain. And what is that reinforcement over and over and over, that obsessive thinking with those things do? Beats the hell out of your little girl or kid. It beats the hell out of your self-esteem. It does not promote self-love. It does not create a healing environment for, you know, CODA work or anything else. So obsession is the core of my self-loathing, you know, of my, you know, my inability to believe in myself, you know, my, you know, the fantasy stories that I make up about if I don't do everything right, then here's the list of all the things that are going to happen. Here's how people are going to treat me. They're going to abandon me. They're going to hate me. They're going to leave me behind, or they're going to take advantage of me, or they're going, you know, they're going to get their way. I'm going to be left in the dust, or whatever the story is, you know, just so much. So what does obsession look like for me? And I think that would be helpful to go back through the, what does obsession look like? Let's see if I can get back up there. That's the one. And to look at what mechanisms does your obsession use? You know, what mechanisms does it use? And that's really important to realize, because we just don't see it. It's like a fish in water. You know, we don't know we're in water until we come across some air and go, oh, well, I've been in water this whole time. I don't even know that. And obsession it's just how I am. It's just what I do. It's just what happens by default in my head all the time. I'm obsessing about what I'm doing wrong, what I'm going to do wrong, what someone else has done wrong. What I have, you know, fear obsession, what, you know, what I should be afraid of. Oh, well, you know, I'm 50 years old and, you know, haven't accomplished this or that or the other, not ready for my retirement, and I never got my degree, or, you know, I mean, just this fantasy fears that come out of nowhere. But I, you know, I have this, this addiction to obsessing where it says, what could I be afraid of today? And then it grabs this little thing and then blows it up out of proportion, you know? And, yeah, I hope you guys can't relate, but you probably can. So what are some painful feelings that have been directly or indirectly caused by my obsession? So I can answer that by saying, shame, top of the list, you know? And I didn't really know it was related to the obsession until I started to see the cycles and I started to see what I did, what my part was. I thought that all the story I was making up in my head was their part, you know, usually, you know, But now I realize that there's a big difference between, you know, how amplified and out of balance and skewed and one-sided that, you know, my obsession could create a story into, and lose track of all of somebody's good qualities, all of the good things that they did, all of the good things that they said, and especially me, right? All of my good, all of my, you know, hope and my hard work and how the love in my heart, my innocence, my, you know, I mean, whatever it was, you know, but if I get into obsession and I've got that confirmation bias part of my brain, which is real, that is a real part of our brain. And I've got that confirmation bias pointed right at fear. What am I going to be afraid of? That's all I can see is all the things that I should be afraid of. And whatever my brain says, it's like a ping pong ball in there, whatever if the ping pong ball is bouncing around and it goes, ooh, fear about that, fear about that, fear about that, fear about that, you know, or anger about that, anger, 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 or, you know, whatever. And I'm really not in those feelings. I'm more intellectualizing those feelings, you know, to avoid all the feelings, you know. So I'm a big, use anger, fear, shamelessness, one up, to avoid, you know, the feelings I don't want to have are powerlessness, loneliness, sadness. Those are vulnerable feelings to me. I feel much, stronger or, safer, I guess is what I'm looking for. You know, I feel much safer and not in my recovery, of course, but you know, I feel much safer being angry than I do being lonely. I feel much safer being, being in worry than I do, you know, feeling, vulnerable, you know? So anyway, back to the question, I've had a lot of painful feelings and there's a lot there to explore, you know, is being able to isolate what was caused by the obsession. How much did I build up that story? How much did I scare the shit out of myself about something that may have had some fear involved? You know, there, it may have been something scary, but I mean, I can just turn it into something catastrophic. And thank God I don't have to live like that anymore. Do I believe obsession has caused me to harm myself or others, and how? Kind of goes with the last question. And I know I can answer that for sure. I've harmed myself for years and definitely harmed others and definitely lost relationships over it. You know, I mean, pushed people away, and villainized them right into like, well, I'm not having nothing to do with her anymore. What do I relate to in what does it cost us, or list other consequences? And I'll really quickly jump back up there. So this is the what does it cost us. If anybody wants to take a screenshot of it. 3, 2, 1. So let's go on to step 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Do I believe that my higher power is capable of helping me arrest my addiction? I hope so, you know, and then why? What evidence do I have in my recovery so far that tells me that my higher power is capable of that? You know, why today I can say, why is because I know that my higher power is unconditionally loving, unconditionally powerful, and that I matter, and that God wants for me to have peace, that God wants for me to be able to think with clarity and balance and stay right sized and use my brain the way that it was intended instead of as a medicator for the rest of my whole body, you know? And, I'm a sexual abuse survivor too. And obsession is common for people that have been through physical trauma as well. Emotional trauma and physical trauma too. But I guess all trauma is physical in some form. So, staying out of my body was preferable for sure. but not so much anymore. I love being in my body. What have I expected obsession to fix, and how was that insane? So for me, I expected obsession to somehow give me the answer that was going to somehow empower me to, you know, overcome something or know how to avoid pain, know how to avoid some big problem. You know, a lot of my obsession was driven by this fear of shame, you know, fear of making a mistake, you know, this fear of, you know, getting, either making a mistake myself and then having severe consequences that I could never live with, or fear of not seeing something coming that someone else was going to do to me, you know? And so as a little kid, I learned how to just, you know, always worry about it, always think about it. What could happen? 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 And so, you know, I went through this chronic anxiety. Not that my real life wasn't bad enough, but to medicate that, which is really sad to think about, you know, to medicate that, you know, the insanity of being in a dysfunctional home with addiction and abuse and, you know, all that stuff. At least my obsession was something that I could try to control, you know, but I expected it to fix everything, to make sense of things, to bring me clarity, to tell me what to do. Basically I was abandoned, you know, and it was supposed to parent me. I didn't know that's what I was looking for, but I was looking for guidance. I was looking for answers. I was looking for understanding. I was looking for someone to care, you know, and that was the best I could care for me at the time. What would sanity look like to me in making decisions or seeking better understanding? I'm going to keep working through these so we have enough time for all the slides. So step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. So here's a reality check for me. How has it worked to turn my will and my life over to my obsession? Because essentially that's what I'm doing when I go in my head for the answers. You know, and I get that jackhammer out and I just start going to town, you know, it's not caring, you know, it's not considerate. It doesn't take into account my feelings, what I need, what I want, how I tried, you know, it doesn't take into account my vulnerability, my innocence, my heart, my heartfelt attempts at things, you know, It doesn't take any of that into account. It has an agenda. It has a focused agenda. It needs to villainize me, or it needs to villainize someone else and victimize me, which also disempowers me. And that's its goal. Its goal is to be right. Its goal is to tear something apart. You know, its goal is to make a big case about whatever, you know, because it has to be intense in order to shut all this down. So it's got to get more and more tense. It's got to get more and more focused. It's got to get more and more dramatic, you know? So yeah, turning my will and my life over to that, you know, didn't land me in better decisions, didn't land me feeling cared about at the end of the day. It just landed me feeling scared as shit, more overwhelmed than I was when I started thinking about it. Feeling lost, abandoned, you know, discarded, you know, and like, it's all just too much. And now I just have to go eat a carton of ice cream, you know, or whatever other addiction that I'm using to balance that one, you know, not really balanced, but, you know, using the fix to fix the fix, the fix, you know? So do I believe that God can care for my will in life better than obsession can, and how and why? And yes. Yes, I do. And God has proven it to me over and over and over again. And you know, when you really think about the damage that obsession does, it's not a very high bar for something else to come in and care for you a little better, you know? And so certainly our higher power can do that. What does faith have to do with arresting my obsession? And I'll just leave that question for you guys to ponder. So recovery. Okay, recovery tools to arrest obsession. I have to move all my little Zoom things around. Hold on. Okay, we must first have boundaries about how, when, where, what, and why we think in order to know whether we are just thinking or obsessing, whether it's healthy or addictive thinking. And I mean, it makes sense, guys. We learn that we have to have boundaries around what we say. We learn that we have to have boundaries around what we eat. You know, we learn that we have to have boundaries around how much we sleep, how much money we spend, who we spend our time with, you know, all these important functions in our lives, you know. But somehow thinking it's not a requirement to have boundaries with our thinking. We're just allowed to go up there and run rampant. You know, we're allowed to think all kinds of shit as long as we filter it before it comes out, you know, and that's kind of, that's like step one in recovery is like learning the filters, you know, but really addressing the source of it and the damage that that's doing internally that then is manifested outside into the world that we bring out, you know, is a whole nother thing. And, you know, we have to be able to identify thinking as, you know, a mechanism by which, you know, that is either a tool or it's a drug, you know, just like food. Food is a tool. So I get my nutrition, you know, and I may get some nurture out of food, or is it a drug? You know, and I'm using it to shut down other feelings, you know? And the same thing is true for thinking. So we have to have boundaries, just like any other part of our lives. So another tool, catch the obsessive thought as soon as you see it and ask your higher power to remove it. You know, there's just some topics, once I know that, like, that's just a topic of obsession, I just can't use that topic manageably. And it doesn't mean that I'm never going to be able to think about it, but I can't just let myself go crazy. I can't think about it with no boundaries. I can't think about it without bringing God into the conversation. You know, I know that once I pick that up and start running, it's over. I've already lost my power. You know, so early recovery is that we think about something and then we notice that we're thinking about it. And, you know, usually that's because we're in pain around the obsession. And then we go, okay, I need to arrest it. Okay, now I need to let it go. And then that window of time as we get more recovery shortens and shortens and shortens, where our awareness jumps in sooner. We can intervene quicker and let it go sooner. And we have stronger tools to surrender it. And so catch it wherever it is. Surrender now, wherever you are, and eventually you can intervene before you even get started. It's never not time to surrender, and then don't let the obsession translate into, oh God, I've been obsessing all this time. You know, just don't let it do that. You know, just don't. Like, you just don't have to. You just don't have to let the obsession turn on you, you know, and start to criticize that you just wasted, or you just did this, or you're doing it wrong, or now you just stop. Just no, not doing it. Grow yourself up. Obsession is always your regressed child running in your head. It's a child in me that's not being parented, that doesn't have care and boundaries and other avenues of managing the feelings of showing up and saying it's going to be okay. Like, let's get a distraction going on. We need to, let's start to do some of our step work, or let's listen to a meditation, or, you know, like, let's get our mind off that and call someone and focus on something else. Confront the obsession's shame-based lies and do power work. So, you know, move the energy with, strong statements such as, I am safe. I am safe. You know, and that drives out the obsession. It drives out the shame. It drives out the fear. I am safe. I am safe. I am safe. I am worthy. I am important. I am okay. This moment is okay. I am okay. And you can take back your power from the obsessive thoughts. There's lots of ways to do power work, but that's a quick one, easy one. We all can do it at any time. Maybe you have to go in the bathroom if you're at work, but and I release this fear. I release this fear. I release this shame. You know, I release this obsession. I do not have to do this to myself. God has got it. And I release this obsession. Identify your feelings behind the desire and care for them. So that's where we show up with that self-parent, soothing, reassuring, comforting, validating. Say the serenity prayer. Put your object of obsession and the obsession. So if I'm obsessing about my ex, it's just an easy example. Then I'm going to put, you know, resentment on a piece of paper and obsession, and then put both of those in my God box, turning that over. I'm turning that over. It's a conscious act of turning that over. Surround yourself with reminders, sticky notes. I like to do phone banners. Like I'll type it on my phone banner. So it pops up every time I see my phone. I have affirmations all over my room. Set an alarm on your phone to pray, you know, like I've done that where I set my alarm on my phone to, you know, like I'll put it out 2 hours and then my phone will go off and I'll be like, oh yeah. All right, God, please take this. And then I go back to work or go back to what I was doing and set my alarm again for 2 hours. And then my phone goes off and I'm like, oh, have I been obsessing? Have I been thinking about it? Am I in fear? And it's like, oh, maybe I'm not, you know, wow, that's nice. That's great. I got to feel the result of that surrender, you know, or I catch myself and I'm doing it again. Okay. Prayer, turn it over. Okay. You know, so the set an alarm on your phone. It's really helpful to me. Redirecting, fill your mind with other thoughts to break the obsessive thinking. So work, what I want to do, activities, watching TV, reading, hobbies, listening to music, meditating. And, you know, and this is where I give myself a break. Even if the choice is not my best self-care, I can get better balance later. I'm arresting addiction here. That is a serious matter. And it takes a lot of focus. So even if I'm binge watching Netflix, that's better than sitting there and obsessing. And that's my opinion, but that has been helpful to me to give myself a break around that. Because I'm not only just dealing with obsession and arresting addiction, all the feelings that are underneath of that are probably going to surface and I have to go through withdrawal. We'll talk a little bit more about that. That's not a fun part. So practice being instead of thinking, you know, with meditation, focused breathing, mantras, all as well. Create your own truth. Create your own happiness. We don't have to be in all those old stories. We need to look at them, acknowledge them, heal them, send love to them, and then move on with our lives. You know, we don't want to be chronic, you know, chronically thinking about all the things that went wrong and all the things that we're afraid of. That's not what we're here to do. Directing your thoughts to focus on joyful self-care like vacations and hobbies and loving people and fun projects. Gratitude lists, right? Very, very hard to retrain my brain to think about those things when I was commuting. Like think about the things you want to do. And I would just be like, I have nothing. I didn't even know how to want. I was so busy always obsessing about what was wrong and what was going to go wrong and what other people wanted and what I did, you know, what I shouldn't do or what I was supposed to do, or I didn't know how to even think about what I want. You know, be accountable by consulting with your sponsor about arresting this aspect of your codependence. And set up a recovery plan with daily calls on your progress. Like take it seriously. Like I said, take it to your first step. Pray for the obsession to be lifted every morning and journal nightly with your inner child or God. You know, it's a good way to stay checked in. Because whatever the obsession was fixing, is, you know, those are going to be feelings that we need to find other ways to care for. And so that's our job. And it's a full-time job. We got plenty to do to not obsess. Building new habits. Remind yourself that your higher power has your highest good in mind, but your brain just has data. And it's only going to have the same data. I've obsessed about this for weeks. It's not going to have any new data when I go in there today. It's not going to come to a new conclusion. I'm not going to get any big old shot of like, aha, I finally figured it out. You know, it's the same stuff I've been thinking about for 6 months. You know, it's the same story. But my higher power has gifts that I can't even imagine. Identify patterns of obsession. So where, who, what, and when. So you know what to surrender and where you're vulnerable. Like I've talked about it a couple times, but commuting was one of my biggest ones. Favorite time to obsess. In the morning, first thing when I would wake up, like all, it would just all flood in, you know, the stories, the worry, the, what am I going to do? The to-do list, the work obsession, the, what do I have to get accomplished today? The who's mad at me, you know, the, you know, just all that would just come flooding in first thing in the morning, you know? And then be gentle with yourself. Once we turn it over, the feelings underneath that are driving the addiction are revealed. So this is the suppressed inner child trauma, PTSD. This means it's time for deeper recovery and healing. Another layer of the onion, lean into self-love, compassion, and forgiveness. It's all okay. We are going to get through this. We are going to build new habits of thinking where you're inner world can become a sanctuary. And then all the outside stuff doesn't have such an impact on you. And that is what, you know, has changed in my recovery. Me and God and my loving, beautiful self-talk and my amazing inner children and my higher self and spirit and the joy that I want and embrace for myself is this inner sanctuary. And when I get caught up here, I'm missing out on all of that. Self-parenting, the true gift. So obsession is a call for help from our inner child. Answering that call is how we build love for ourselves that is sustaining, fulfilling, and empowering. Self-intimacy develops as we arrest the obsession and gently face fears, explore thoughts, feel feelings, and trust God while letting life unfold within and around us in our own care. It's a whole different way to live. Self-parenting is learning to think kindly, caring, compassionately, and honestly. How would you want a friend to talk to you, a parent, or your higher power? And then why do we tolerate the kind of criticism and you know, fearful catastrophizing in our head? Like we would shut someone down generally, you know, on the outside, if they were doing that to us, but we can do it to ourselves. Explore the real motives behind your obsession. What is it fixing? Talk to the little you and ask about the overwhelming feelings. Let little him or her express all the fear, anger, overwhelm, outrage, shame, injustice, confusion, and pain. You know, validate, hear that stuff, and then care for them. Apply comfort to pain. Apply courage to fear. Apply understanding to confusion. Apply shame to love or love to shame. Apply soothing to overwhelm. Faith to hopelessness. Togetherness to loneliness. Freedom to obligation. Sometimes just be with them and listen. You know, and as you build that intimate relationship with yourself, you know, or continue to, or I'm sure many of you have, you know, then you know what you need when you come across that feeling. You know what you need. And then we build skills to be able to give that to ourselves. Identify any actions that you are neglecting, afraid of, frozen, or avoiding. And instead directing that energy into this internal hamster wheel process that feels safer because you control it. Grow yourself up with God's help, get right-sized with what is scaring you, and ask God for the courage to take action. life is not as big and overwhelming as it feels. Build a better understanding of healthy decision making. Gather information, sit with it, ask others, wait for what feels right. Consult those you trust. Have a backup plan. Be open-minded. Be teachable in the moment and unattached to expectations. And as we change our values, we change our lives. So this is something that me and God came up with, and it's a way to look at healthy thinking and how to have boundaries around that. And so T stands for time boundary, create a sobriety boundary. So if I'm going to go in and think about something, you know, maybe I've been abstinent from thinking about my ex for a while, but now I do need to think about something. I need to think about, you know, our custody arrangement, or I need to think about how I'm going to approach him with a request or a boundary or something. So I need to think about him. Okay. Well, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to go in with a time boundary. So I'm not going to just give myself room to run and no boundaries at all. I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to just think about this for 10 or 15 minutes. And one of the ways that I have learned to do that, and this I learned in NA, is bookending, where there's something coming up that I'm going to do in 15 minutes, you know? And so now I'm going to take this 15 minutes and do this. But at the end of it, there's this transition. So I can't just run with it forever because I'm going to, you know, call my sponsor, or I'm going to have dinner or serve dinner or start cooking dinner, or I'm going to, you know, there's a movie that's coming on, you know? And so bookending helps me with that, you know? So I'm not going to think about that while I'm commuting, right? Because that's my favorite place to use. So I have to have that boundary where when I'm in the car, I'm talking to God, I'm listening to podcasts, you know, about uplifting things. I don't use that time to think about issues, because that is perfect obsession time. And that's how I have a abstinence boundary around that. So, you know, everybody's obsession is going to be personal to them. So you have to work on creating your own boundaries for that. But, so H is for higher power. So I'm going to pray for God's will, support, and care. So I'm going to pull God into that conversation before I even get started. And I is for inner child. So before I start this, you know, sensitive topic, whatever it is, I'm going to check in with my inner child and make sure that I'm in my parent and that my child is not in charge of this conversation, that this isn't a conversation that my inner child is having, but this is me and my adult in myself parent caring for my life with boundaries. Children are very often boundaryless. It's the nature of a child. So I don't want my inner child to be worrying and picking it up and making a big thing out of it and getting scared or getting dramatic or catastrophizing. So I've got to check in with that child. And one of the best ways to do that is if I see my child and I address my child, I know I'm in the parent just by the nature of that communication. N is for neutral. So I'm going to check in with myself. Am I right size right now? Am I open-minded? I'm not in fantasy mode with a target. You know, like I'm angry at somebody and I'm going to start thinking about it because I want to build a case against them. And it's going to give me a big one up. It's going to give, you know, it's going to fix my, you know, feelings. Like I need to learn how to be aware of that. Like, no, I'm mad at this person. I'm not neutral. This is not the time to be thinking about this. I'm not going to be thinking about it with boundaries. K is for kindness. So practice moving thoughts and motives towards compassion, not just for me, but compassion for anyone else involved in this situation. And then I is for inventory. So once I'm starting to think about it, I'm going to use my fourth step and do a searching and fearless exploring of the situation, my feelings, what I feel like I need for care, what I need for self-care, what my responsibilities are. And I'm going to walk through it, you know, in a searching and fearless way with my higher power. So then N, there's going to be an end to it. I'm not just going to obsess endlessly, right? So now I come to the conclusion. I've done my inventory. I've covered the information. I've felt it. I've processed it. What's my next right thing? So given what I know now, what is my next right action? I come to a conclusion. I wrap this up. I don't just leave this unending open opportunity to go use and obsess and worry and scare myself or leave it and never make progress on making a decision and stepping into action. So I have to do my next right thing. And sometimes the next right thing is I'm going to put it back on the shelf and circle back to it later, you know, and that's perfectly acceptable, you know, but my obsession says, no, you can't do that. You got to figure it out, you know, and then I know that obsession is in charge, you know, and then God, geez, for God. So pray for the power to carry it out. And this is a really healthy tool, you know, and, for me, you know, to be able to identify whether I'm in healthy thinking or obsession and like what the components are for that. So that's pretty much it. This is the last slide. I'm going to read this. This came to me the other night when I was putting this together and finalizing it. To me, God's will for me is more than a list I should or shouldn't do. God's will is a state of open-mindedness, surrender, and possibility. It is flowing, changing, and evolving like me, and unlimited, benevolent, and unconditionally loving like God. Since it's not a list of rights and wrongs, I'm not going to find it in my head with logic, statistics, or rules, not to mention the stories, assumptions, denial, or PTSD. There's a lot up in there. So if I'm looking for God's will in my head, I'm searching in the wrong place. The truth is that I'm going to feel it in my heart and know it in my being. It's going to come to me holistically and spiritually, and maybe not on demand, but over time through a process. And I put hint, hint, spiritual awakening. Sometimes God has a deeper wisdom of why I need to sit with something, why it doesn't resolve and go away really fast, you know. So if I'm in my head, I may completely miss the miracle, the insight, the aha that I'm trying so desperately to achieve. Or worse, I may miss something amazing I don't even know God has in store for me. Obsession blocks me from the one thing that is certain to present the best and highest possible outcome, God's will. And I am no longer willing to give that up. So help me, God. So help me, God. So. That's it. I am done and on time. That was God. I got to tell you, that was God. So I'm going to stop my share. And like I said, anyone that wants the PDF of this workshop can send me an email and I'll shoot it over to you. And I wish that we had more time for Q&A or chit chat. I'd love to hear your guys' feelings and experiences and stuff. But you know, it was a lot of information to cover in a short amount of time. And I just thank you for listening and letting me share my experience, strength, and hope around this. And I pray that, that you all arrest your obsession if you have it. It's worth it. Fight for you.
Thank you so much, Heidi. That was incredible.